Are there any objections to the changes? All right. Thank you. So, do I have a motion?
Madam Chair, I propose that we accept the House rules on transportation with the Scrivener errors as proposed by Representative Butler.
Any objections? All right. So moved. So passed or whatever. We'll learn. I think during this part, we'll go ahead and introduce the committee members, and we can start over on this side with Representative Reed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Tobias Reed, representing District 27, which is Beaverton, parts of Southwest Portland, some unincorporated Washington and Altman County. In my life outside the legislature, I work at Nike as a footwear developer. I think our district has a lot of concerns around transportation. I'm eager to get to work and learn from my committee members. Thanks.
A lot of rural roads out there, other representatives.
Okay. Crowded.
I'm probably the oldest guy here, so far as service in the legislature. I'm colleagues. I'm Tom Butler from House District 60, which has 25%+ of the landmass of the state of Oregon in that district. The only person that claims anything larger than that in this district or in this state is either the governor or Ted Ferrioli, who is Senate District 30, which includes that district. Lots of transportation issues in House District 60, and I'm pleased to be associated with all my colleagues here. Thank you very much.
I'm Carolyn Tomei, State Representative for House District 41, which is Milwaukee and Southeast Portland. And we have 99E going right through my district. And another big issue that we'll be dealing with in my district is light rail coming from Portland through Southeast Portland into Milwaukee.
Representative George Gilman, District 55. My district's just a little smaller than Tom's, but not very much. It's all of Lake and Crook County, northern half of Klamath County, about a third of Jackson County, and a little bit of Deschutes thrown in for good measure. I'll always be a strong supporter of a good transportation system, and part of that includes 140 going clear to Nevada.
I'm Representative Peter Buckley from District 5, which is Ashland, Talent, Phoenix, a little bit of West Medford in Jackson County there. We have transportation challenges and opportunities, both in terms of traffic, in terms of moving freight, in terms of our airport, and in terms of rail, and very much also in terms of public transportation with our Rogue Valley Transportation District. So I look forward to making progress on all those areas in this committee, and thanks for having me.
Thank you.
I'm Representative Greg Smith. I have the distinct pleasure of representing District 57, which is Wallowa and Union and Morrow and the best parts of Umatilla County. I look forward to working with each and every one of you and learning about transportation issues from each and every one of you. So thank you for having me here.
Thank you. Representative Terry Beyer, I represent District 12, which is Springfield. This will be my third session on transportation, first as chair, so bear with me as we get the hang of this. And I look forward to working with all of you. And please make sure if you have any questions, get in touch with me. I'd be happy to sit down with you. And then I'm going to let our committee staff introduce themselves.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Judith Callens. I've been serving the Oregon legislature in this capacity for approximately 12 years almost going on. It's hard for me to believe that. I very much look forward to being back on working on the House side after being in the Senate for a couple of sessions. So I am here and ready to serve any of the committee members. If you have any needs whatsoever, do not hesitate to give me a call. The number is right at the top of the agenda.
Thank you. Gary?
Gary Rullier. This is my third session. In the 99 session, I was the committee assistant for the Senate Transportation Committee.
Thank you. I'm going to close the organizational meeting. We're going to start on the informational meeting. I just first off want to say that sorry about the kinks with the switching committees earlier and the delay. Hopefully we can get that worked out in the future. I certainly hope so. And And our first guest and person to testify is Chris Warner, who is with the governor's office, and he'll be talking about the governor's transportation initiative. Or
thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Beyer, Representatives Gilman, Representatives Tomei, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Chris Warner. I'm the governor's transportation policy advisor. Chair Beyer asked me to come by today and talk a little bit about what the governor's kind of priorities are with transportation. I'd also like to talk about some of the work we've done over the past few sessions with much of your help. And then also, we'll let Matt take it from there. But I'd like to kind of talk about what we've done and also some of the future things that we would like to do. Certainly talking about the work of the recently completed Oregon Transportation Plan, which I think is a very good blueprint for the next 25 years as we take a look at the transportation system as a whole. Certainly in the investments that we've made over the past number of sessions, a lot of you that are new to the transportation world, you'll hear about OTIA, which is the Oregon Transportation Investment Act. We've had OTIA 1, 2, and 3 since 2001, and they really have provided some badly needed infrastructure for our highway system, about $3 billion over basically a 10-year investment for our it's funding for the state highway system and the work we're doing, but also for the cities and counties. A big chunk of that money also went to the cities and counties for their transportation systems, which are vitally important as we talk about the entire transportation system. Certainly last session, a number of you, most of you with the exception of Representative Reed who were here, supported Connect Oregon, which was really Oregon's first real investment into the multimodal transportation system. It was a $100 million investment in our aviation, our marine, aviation, marine, transit, and rail facilities. So that was badly needed investment. I'll talk a little bit more as we go along in terms of how those investments have panned out. But it's been very valuable just for every business and individual in the state in terms of making those making our system work better. I'll talk a little bit about ODOT and where we are as a state agency that's really charged with the delivery of this, you know, this money that we entrust with them, about $2.7 billion for the 0507 biennium. The governor's been very pleased with the work ODOT's been doing in terms of getting the project design, workers on the site, and the jobs completed. The issue that we, I think the governor talks a lot about is when we're driving around the state, we see the cranes, whether it's down at the Beltway area where we were last weekend or wherever we are in the state in terms of the investments we made in the roads and bridges. It's been great to actually not have the money sitting on the shelf, but actually getting the money out there, people back to work, and also making those critical modernization investments. Studies have shown that about every $1 million invested in transportation construction, about 17 family wage jobs are created. So looking at the numbers, that would be about 21,000 jobs have been created through the OTIA project, which is a wonderful public works program that actually goes a long way to strengthen the economy. Just a kind of
Madam Chair, do you want us to ask questions at the end, or may I ask them?
Actually, I think we're probably okay, so if you have a question,
sure,
we can go ahead and do that.
Thank you. Thank you. Chris, of those 20,000 jobs, can you tell us how many are local people?
Yeah, I can actually, I think later my testimony talks about, nearly all the jobs have been Oregon contractors. I think more than 90% of the jobs were built and designed by Oregon contractors. So
thank you.
Mm-hmm. So, stepping back and looking at OTIA 1 and 2, about 100% of those projects are under design, construction, or completed. Over two-thirds of the OTIA 3 projects are either in design, under construction, or completed. As I said a moment ago, more than 90% of these projects were designed and built by Oregon firms, and the agency is especially paying close attention to ensuring that the workforce is available and diverse, and that small businesses can participate in the construction projects. Part of that is done by the bundling process in terms of how we put them out to bid. So the departments work very hard to make sure that it's just not the big firms that are getting it, that we have smaller firms, and also trying to diversify the workforce as well has been very important. Certainly with Connect Oregon, I'll talk about the implementation of that. We're off and running with that. In July of 2006, the OTP, or the Oregon Transportation Commission, approved the 43 projects for funding under the program. The first $25 million was the bonds were already sold. The next 75 are going to be going out the door this spring. So we're very excited about that. There was a little gap in the bonding because we wanted to see what happened with measures 41 and 48 in terms of where we are with our bond capacity, but we're confident now that we'll move forward with that additional $75 million this fall. The benefits of the Connect Oregon program are really magnified by the fact that that in many cases these were the final piece of the funding for many projects that otherwise may not have been constructed. Certainly there was a 20% match that was part of the requirement for Connect Oregon, but I think you'll see that it equaled about $229 million in projects in terms of if you look at the local match plus what we had on the table. So it's been an incredibly successful program. What I'll do is highlight a number of the projects. I think within your material I highlighted the consensus committee's recommendations, and those are the projects we're moving forward on. For instance, the Lane Transit District and the Bus Rapid Transit System, Chair Beyer and I had the opportunity and the pleasure to go for the opening of the Pioneer Parkway, or the Franklin Corridor project over the weekend, and the dollars that were from Connect Oregon will be for the Pioneer Parkway extension, which is vital for the Eugene Springfield area. It provides the loop that starts in Springfield, goes around to the Peace Health and the area out there, which is the real job growth area in Lane County. So it's a wonderful project, and the administrator from the Federal Transit Administration was out here and was very impressed by the work by Lane Transit District, but also by the participation in the state in this project. So we're very excited about that. The Port of Coos Bay Phase 2 for the railroad bridge. Years ago I worked for Congressman DeFazio, and we've invested many dollars over the years in that bridge, and so we're very excited to see additional investment in that bridge, because the work they're trying to do out at the Port of Coos Bay and landing some of the big companies, which hopefully will be on track. I think the investment in that railroad bridge is absolutely critical. Port of Arlington, a barge intermodal facility, $1.9 million of Connect Oregon money was for that. And then money in the Union Railway, the excursion train, which is a great boost for Union and Wallowa counties in terms of keeping that right-of-way in actual rail use and not losing that. So we're excited to be able to help with that. So that's kind of an overview of Connect Oregon, and I can answer any questions if you had any questions on any of those. If not, I will move right into the Oregon Transportation Plan. Certainly, the transportation plan is kind of what we call the far-looking vision for where we need to be with our transportation infrastructure. It was adopted in 2006 by the legislature after 2 years of work. The OTP, as we call it, basically describes a vision for a vital transportation system. It's a comprehensive plan that assesses both the state and the local, the public and the private transportation facilities, and the commission and the department look at it as a guide to really steer our investments in terms of where we can get the best bang for the buck for the state, regional, and the local level. I think there are kind of three findings that in many ways, I think, if nothing else, will spark the conversation where we need to go with our transportation infrastructure, in the sense that freight is expected to increase by 80% over the next 25 years. So imagine, you know, all the trucks and the freight you see out there right now, and imagine that, you know, nearly doubling. So that's pretty incredible. Certainly our population is going to grow by 41%. And then kind of the most provocative question in terms of the fuel tax, which is the traditional means for funding our highways and roads, we'll lose about 40 to 50% of its buying power due to inflation. We haven't raised the gas tax since 1993, and as we've seen in the last few years, just with the OTIA projects, the price of asphalt and steel has made a lot of these transportation projects much more expensive. So you can see that our buying power is really quite jeopardized by where we are with the way we fund our transportation system. So in terms of what the OTP finds, it basically finds as Oregon grows and competes in the global economy, the demand for an efficient transportation system for its people and its goods, it really does increase. The OTP estimates that improving the maintenance of Oregon's transportation system, replacing our infrastructure and equipment, and adding incremental capacity, which we talk a lot about the incremental capacity, but certainly would require about $3.5 billion annually, and in 2004, we spent about $2.2 billion, which leaves a gap of $1.3 billion. And in terms of that $1.3 billion gap, I think that's a rather modest increase in the modernization. Certainly, I know that everyone in the committee has transportation issues within their own districts. Last week when the Senate committee met, I think they were competing for who had the most congestion and who had the most problems, whether it's 217 or the Clackamas, some of the challenges out in Clackamas County. The Newburgh-Dundee bypass is another project that's incredibly expensive. Yet our modernization budget, is very, very modest. And even if we did do a little bit of increase, whether or not we could pay for these, what in essence are super projects, it's very hard to sell. So the 2006 OTP describes the options that really faces the state. We can basically do nothing, and the system in itself will deteriorate, providing neither the livable communities nor the base for the economic development that we all really want. We can increase the funding to keep up with inflation, to maintain the system, and address major bottlenecks, but not really add substantial capacity. Or we can judicially apply for new funding to meet the most serious maintenance and congestion problems while looking for innovative technologies, alternative funding, and organizational solutions that we can take care of the system for the long run. So those are basically the challenges and kind of the issues that the OTP set out. And certainly, then I think the discussion we have to have as policymakers is if we make these strategic investments, we need to work closely with public and private partners to maximize really the taxpayers' resources and using kind of what we refer to as the innovation to improve the safety and the efficiency of the system. One of the things Gail Ackerman, who was the chair of the OTP, talks a lot about is the system itself isn't in failure. It's just in failure a few times, during the day. And so we have to kind of talk about if there are other kinds of efficiencies, the way we kind of, use that system, if there are different ways that we can basically use those investments more wisely and more creatively. So this session the governor's proposed, I think, Connect Oregon 2, which we think will mirror the bill passed by the 2005 legislature and provide an additional $100 million for the multimodal system. We think that's important because under Connect Oregon, I think there were more than $238 million of projects that were requested, and that was under a very, very tight timeline in terms of getting the applications, the rules done. So I think we feel that there is still a very big demand for these kind of investments, and the governor feels very strongly that we really do need to round out our transportation system and invest additional monies in our multimodal system. One other thing that I wanted to bring you to your attention, many of you were at the recent Oregon Business Summit, and transportation was a featured issue. The business plan that the Oregon Business Summit came forward with is going to urge the legislature to add about $300 to $350 million annually in spending for highways. I think that's part of the plan as it moves forward. It'll target transportation projects that deliver statewide economic benefit, like the Columbia River Crossing, which I'm sure we'll be talking about that during the session, but it is a critical piece of the whole transportation infrastructure in terms not only for Oregon but for the West Coast. The kind of the bottleneck that kind of occurs as we come through Portland is going to be critical as we try to move that 80% increase in freight. Certainly the business community will be taking the lead in moving forward a proposal for funding for consideration to the legislature. And I think kind of the governor's urging is for us to work together with the business community to see what exactly the best investment structure would be, or investment strategy for the state would be. To help with this deliberation, if you will, is that there's a cost of congestion study that the folks in the Oregon Business Summit are working on in the Portland Business Alliance. The Portland Business Alliance did a cost of congestion study for the Portland area last year, which showed basically. And I think that would be actually maybe a good session for you to have to take a look at that study. But it showed basically for every $2 for every dollar investment in terms of our economic vitality. Certainly, whether it's delays, whether it's Intel getting chips out to the airport, or some of these other things, those investments that are made are actually, for not making the investments, it's costing our businesses an incredible amount of money every year. So they're in the process of doing an analysis, which we should have by the end of the month, where we can actually, you know, continue the discussion not only in the Portland area but statewide, because it's not only Portland that has a lot of these critical transportation infrastructure investments. So I guess in summation, the governor understands that a vibrant transportation system is absolutely critical for Oregon's economy to grow and to prosper. We've had major accomplishments over the few years, and I want to thank all the work that many members on this committee have done in moving forward a lot of those transportation investments. It's been absolutely critical, and without your help, we couldn't have done it. But certainly, despite these accomplishments, there's going to be serious challenges facing the system, and the ability for businesses to compete locally and globally. And without these investments, it'll make it difficult for our citizens, you know, just to get around in their own community. So I think part of today is just to continue this transportation conversation. I wanted to bring the Oregon Transportation Plan to your attention. And so we can kind of talk about how we fund the system, whether it's now, or this is an issue that's not going to go away no matter what we do this session, but it's certainly something that I think needs to be highlighted not only within the public policymakers but within the business community. And I think they do identify that this is a big problem. So I'd be happy to answer any questions, and after that I think I'll yield to Matt, and he'll kind of talk about some of the other departmental issues. So any hard questions you can say for him, I guess. So.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chris, my concern is that that with the same kinds of issues of Connect Oregon and OTIA 3, local governments are having every bit of the difficulty, and I know that there are proposals to help those folks get their arms around the problems that they have locally. Anything in the governor's package that helps local government address the deteriorating and the loss of transportation ability locally?
Chair Beyer, Senator Representative Butler, thank you for bringing that up, because that was in my notes and I forgot to discuss that, because that is a critical issue for rural Oregon, as you know. This morning, in fact, our office met with a number of the folks. We have somebody in Washington, D.C. that's working on this issue. This is what Representative Butler is speaking of is the county payments legislation that expired earlier this year, and it is a huge hit not only for the transportation system for the local counties, but also for the human resources, for the schools. It's just a tremendous hit. I know Representative Butler knows this, but my brother is the chair of the Baker County Commission, so I get lots of calls concerning, what have you done for me lately? But certainly it's an issue of critical importance to the governor. We have spent a lot of staff time dealing with that, and, we are still optimistic that we can get something, get some kind of a reauthorization, whether it's on the continuing resolution or whether it's a full reauthorization, which would be wonderful. But it's certainly an issue of critical importance, and I think any discussion of kind of additional funding would probably involve what's going on with the counties, because it's a huge issue.
Madam Chair, just by way of comment, if I may, Oregon's delegation that was in the majority party went from 2 to 5, and I would hope in that process that we'd now have an opportunity to make sure that those funds are forthcoming to back to the state of Oregon under Public Law 109-393 or 106-393.
106.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Beyer. I did not know your brother was the Baker County Chair. Interesting.
It's a not too well discovered secret. So,
Chris, I just wanted to to say thank you to you and to the governor for the leadership you've provided the state of Oregon in terms of transportation issues. And I also want you to know that you have one heck of a department behind you that does one heck of a good job. Committee, during our introductions, I probably should have shared a little more with you. I work quite often with transportation carriers throughout Eastern Oregon. As a matter of fact, I probably should have declared a conflict of interest right up front to you on a lot of our issues. But one of the themes I hear over and over is just how well the Oregon Department of Transportation does in working with our local partners. And I just want you to know that, Chris, that you got a good group of folks there that are running the shop.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chris, just a clarification. The comment about the business plan requesting $300 to $350 million annually, is that in addition to what's in the governor's recommended budget?
Yes.
Thank you.
My understanding is, and you know, and we still haven't seen any proposal, but that's the kind of the dollar figure that they're looking at in terms of some kind of a transportation package. Yeah.
Thank you.
Any more questions?
Can I just make a comment? If my constituents are watching this, they're probably cursing me at this moment because I have not mentioned the Salad Bridge, and I'm mentioning that to you and to Matt also, that it's in my district. It has more cars or vehicles going over the Selwood Bridge, a two-lane bridge, than any other two-lane bridge in the state, and it is crumbling, and so I certainly want us to be thinking about that in the next few months.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
If I may, I just wanted to just echo Representative Smith's comments on the work of the department. And I probably didn't say it enough in there, but the governor's just been pleased with the work the department's doing. I think the Highway 35 reopening was kind of a proud moment for the department in terms of actually, you know, hanging in there and getting the job done. And Matt's just done a superb job, and I just wanted to echo his comments. So.
Thank you. I will say in my district we have a project going on that involves ODOT and it involves the county and the city, and all the people out there are all saying, which I never thought I'd hear before, oh, I wish everybody could run like ODOT's running because the city and the county are just doing a terrible job right now. And it wasn't something that I think we would have heard a while back. So
thank you.
Okay, the next is the Department of Transportation and Matt Garrett. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome.
The Chair Byer, members of the committee, I'm Matthew Garrett. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Transportation, and I feel like with everything said, I should just say thank you and not say a word. But that said, I want to share with you that myself and my agency look forward to working with each and every one of you. I want to express my appreciation for your leadership and vision in the past and as we move to opportunities in the future. I look forward to having a robust conversation. It is my privilege to be here today to give you an overview of the agency, how we're doing, who we are, what we're doing. I thought Mr. Warner did nothing short of an outstanding job in laying a foundation, and I apologize in advance if indeed I am somewhat redundant, because I will speak to some of these points, because some of these points specifically with regard to delivery I think are important. So I apologize in advance, but I will be somewhat redundant, but there are points I want to make. Now that said, I want to begin right on the very first page and have you look at the mission of the Oregon Department of Transportation: to provide a safe, efficient transportation system that supports economic opportunity, livable communities for Oregonians. I think right there it expresses that this agency is multifaceted in its disciplines, and we have a big, complex business that we conduct, and we serve many masters. But the capacity to deal with that reside in the men and women of ODOT. Our values. We have seven values. I will literally walk through this document and speak to some of the issues from it. We have seven values that we honor. The first and foremost is safety. It is the golden thread that weaves its way through all our activities. And simply put, I tell this to my people. I tell this to the folks that work with us in the private sector. The most important thing for me as a director is to make sure folks come to work safe and they go home to their family and friends safely. That's the bottom line. And I think the focus that this agency brings to safety helps ensure that. Customer focus. We heard a little bit out in some of your comments. The bottom line, this is nothing more than an attitude of coming to the table with a solutions-oriented approach. And I am very proud that my agency comes to the table to take on the many challenges with the right attitude. We look at efficiency. This is just something extremely important to the agency as we try to continue to improve. We try to adapt and evolve in the environment and the challenges we face in this environment. Accountability. Straightforward conversations. Open, honest, clear, concise. Conversations that seek to find resolution to problems. Problem solving, again, I think we as an agency invest the appropriate amount of times in all our relationships, whether they're internal or external to the agency, whether they're public sector or private sector members. We will exhaust various avenues as we search for solutions. Positive workforce just simply means we will treat our own folks as well as those folks that we conduct business with in a professional and respectful manner. And then finally, the environment. What it says to me is we try to find solutions that truly fit in to the environment, to integrate into the system, whether it's a project or a program or a process. Context-sensitive and sustainable solutions, again, where we try to better understand the context for the vision, the community's vision for a transportation solution. Take that vision, somehow integrate it in to the transportation or the engineering solution we make, integrate that for a solution that, at the end of the day, is embraced by all. We move to who we are. I spoke of the capacity of the men and women of ODOT, and I will tell you that they are some of the most dedicated, professional, and passionate people I know. I've had the privilege over the interim to ride circuit throughout the state of Oregon, and this is reinforced each and every time in person or in action. Mr. Warner represented the Highway 35. Emergency we had. Again, more than just a transportation emergency. This was an economic emergency for the good folks up on the mountain, as well as Hood River and Central Oregon. But the passion of the ODOT maintenance folks, the passion of our public, our private sector partners in Tri-State Construction delivered that project earlier than we'd anticipated, even though Mother Nature threw some heavy blows early on. She provided us a little break with weather that allowed us to move forward and open that up to save the ski season for a significant business up there, as well as making sure the product that moves from Hood River to Central Oregon and beyond had an efficient way to go. I truly believe that the men and women of ODOT are among the best and brightest in state government. And again, as I said, that's reinforced. We are 4,700 strong. We are all points across the great state of Oregon, whether it's in the highway portfolio, whether it's serving Oregonians behind the DMV counter, working with a commercial driver's license and beyond. Let me quickly walk through the eight portfolios, what we do as an agency, and I'll start with transportation safety. This is really where we articulate the four E's, as we call them: engineering, enforcement, education, and emergency services. Nice little bumper sticker tunes, but there's a reality to each and every one of those efforts. In the education, in the engineering, in the enforcement, it ripples through situations like the number of fatalities that unfortunately take place each and every year in the state of Oregon. But I will tell you, since 1980, our efforts have reduced fatalities in Oregon by 60%. The education, seat belt use, behavior. How do people, when they get behind an automobile, the obligations and responsibilities of making sure that they're focused, they're not distracted when they're driving, but they're making themselves safe. Seat belt use. 96% of Oregonians use their seat belt. That ranks us always in the top three, and we kind of migrate and bounce back and forth amongst the top three. We move to the highway portfolio. Again, this is where we maintain and we preserve and we grow that highway asset. Roughly 8,000 miles of road, representing about 9% of the roadways in the state of Oregon, but carrying 60%+ of the volume. So a heavy burden carried, but yet maintained. I spoke to the issue of emergency services or emergency repairs on Highway 35 yesterday. Throughout the Willamette Valley, again, it was the ODOT forces that engaged to make sure that Once Mother Nature dealt us a blow, we engaged with our maintenance forces to help clean things up. And for all intents and purposes, things are much better within a 24,000 period. But just to tell you very quickly what that cost us, roughly in that 24-hour period, we dropped about $220,000. It's the rough estimate of all the activities that transpired in that 24-hour period. It's a big, complex, and expensive business. We moved to public transit. Here's where we have grants moving through this portfolio to the tune of about $44 million that play themselves out over 200 providers throughout the great state of Oregon. We take those personnel and ride circuit to better inform small cities, rural transit districts, those folks dealing with senior and disabled transportation in terms of technical assistance, in terms of financial assistance. We move to the next portfolio, rail. Safety and regulation are first and foremost in our conversations amongst our rail partnerships. We also coordinate heavily with the short lines, with the Class 1s and Union Pacific, Burlington Northern, Santa Fe. We focus and invest on freight and passenger rail. We actually promote two trains that run up and down the corridor. We enforce safety to the tune that we do the track inspections, the crossings and such. We also help manage and improve projects that help deliver more than 68 million tons of cargo through the year. Our driver and motor vehicle services, DMV, again, this is where we test the skills of drivers. This is where we issue roughly $2.9 million driver's license and IDs. We title roughly 4 million registered vehicles throughout the state of Oregon, and we regulate the various vehicle-related businesses. Motor carrier transportation. This is truly the trucking industry where we register the commercial trucks and buses. We collect the weight mile tax. We also, and this is roughly a little over a decade old, but we were innovative early on in this area with the green light pre-clearance program, looking at the quick transmission through transponders of information to allow trucks to continue moving down the interstate rather than pulling in into a way station to transmit and communicate information. We have this pre-clearance program, which is saving the trucking industry roughly 113,000 hours, which equates to about a little over $13 million. So again, an efficiency that's good for us. It's also good for the trucking industry, which means it's good for the economy of the state of Oregon. We move to the next portfolio, which is our transportation development, truly the planning portfolio. Chris spoke to the Oregon Transportation Plan. It is here in the Transportation Development Division where that pick and shovel work take place. Guides and support both our short-term and long-term range plannings, working with cities and counties on data on their transportation system plans as well. Central services really is just the administrative arm of the agency, focusing on financial, human resource, procurement, fleet, those types of activities. So we move to slide 5. This is what we look like on paper, for all intents and purposes, and representing the 8 portfolios and the good men and women who lead those portfolios. We'll move on to slide 6, where we speak to some of the conversations we have with Oregonians, how we conduct the transportation dialogue. Probably the best investment, this is my observation, the best investment and decision that the Transportation Commission has made in the last 10 years or so was when they established the Area Commissions on Transportation. Prior to that, there were independent conversations by the hundreds of stakeholders who had interest in transportation. They would literally come before the Transportation Commission and engage and issue debate before the Commission. Not very focused, not very disciplined, and not very productive. Again, roughly 1996-97, the conversations. What if we gather folks together, cluster some counties who have common interests, make a composition of local elected officials, of business leaders, of civic leaders, of just transportation stakeholder folks, the citizens who want to engage, sit them around the table, let them vet and have a disciplined conversation about what is important for their region in terms of transportation. Have them prioritize and rank and make recommendations specific to projects and programs, as well as policies. That conversation has been playing itself out for the last 10 years. The area commissions will continue to mature. We've seen that with the Oregon Transportation Investment Act, again, where they were help vetting those projects, making sure that the recommendations that did indeed come to the Oregon Transportation Commission were thoroughly vetted, and that was the best investment with those finite funds. They continue to mature as we moved into the Connect Oregon conversation, so they moved beyond the highway portfolio to a multimodal discipline, engaging with the various modal advisory committees outlined in Connect Oregon. And that integration of thought produced, I think, some of the best minds working on delivering the 43 projects that came out of Connect Oregon. So a good investment. It has indeed better informed the overall transportation conversation, and the area commissions on transportation will continue to mature and take help on my agency as well as my commission take on the challenges that come before us in the world of transportation. How we're governed. Again, we receive input from a lot of people. Where does it come? It comes to the Oregon Transportation Commission. This is truly our policy board. You can see that the commission is a five-member board appointed by the governor and confirmed or with the consent, I should say, of the Oregon State Senate. It's a volunteer group. Again, Commissioner Gail Ackerman was on point for the Oregon Transportation Plan. I can't tell you how blessed we are to have individuals who are so committed to the transportation conversation, and we identify the five members. These are folks of intelligence, of character and integrity, who advance the transportation conversation in the state of Oregon. Stuart Foster is our chair from the Medford area. Gail Ackerman from the Portland / Corvallis area. Mike Nelson representing the good folks in Eastern Oregon from Baker City. And then Randy Pape from Eugene. And then Janice Wilson, the newest member, who comes from the Portland metro area. So they truly are our policy board, helping direct and inform the transportation conversation, insisting the Oregon Department of Transportation in handling this multi-billion dollar asset we've been handled with. Now, what are the roles that the transportation plays? To me, the conversation is really captured in saying I want to tell everyone transportation is not an end unto itself. It's a means to many ends. It's a means to an economic end. It's a means to a land use end. It's an economic development end. It's a livable community end. So again, a hub issue, but a hub issue with many spokes. Chris did speak on a financial side that for every $1 million invested in a transportation project, it yields 17 family wage jobs. Again, the importance to the economy. So what does a sound transportation look like? Again, it connects the state. It connects it either through the roads, through the rivers, or through the rails, or aviation. But you have to have that tie, that bind. It's the economic circulatory system that allows our people as well as our product to move efficiently and safely throughout the state. It certainly facilitates desired growth. I think it goes without saying that a strong transportation system is a key element to attracting business to the state of Oregon. It reduces the cost of congestions. Again, if we are making the appropriate investments, we are removing those barriers, those obstacles to an efficient flow of commerce and goods. We are also promoting the economic productivity and competitiveness of Oregon firms, and I think that's a charge that we accept at the Oregon Department of Transportation. And it promotes success through all areas of Oregon. Again, we recognize the uniqueness of all the areas through the great state of Oregon. And again, we want to assure that their product and their people are moving efficiently, and transportation, a healthy transportation system, is certainly an important ingredient to that success. How do we plan? Chris did indeed speak to the Oregon Transportation Plan. It is the document that describes the long-term vision, a 25-year look out into the future to look at the opportunities and the challenges that we will expect. He spoke to some of those challenges, the increase in freight. And again, 80% increase in the next 20, 25 years. And he said that 75% of that, that freight volume will continue to travel by truck. So we can see some of the challenges we face in our highway portfolio if you're down in southern Oregon and you get caught behind some of those trucks. There's just nowhere to move. You can just extend out your arguments as this growth comes forward. As population will increase, vehicle miles traveled will increase on an aging infrastructure. The wear and tear will play us out. And then the inflationary bite, as Chris mentioned, as you look out that 25 years, the vision of the OTP, the inflationary bite does compromise the purchasing power to the tune of 40 to 50%. As the OTP establishes various goals, policies, strategies, and initiatives, they really boil down to six key initiatives. The first is to maintain the system and maximize the value of the asset. This is just, again, make sure that the multi-billion dollar asset that the citizens of Oregon have invested in, we don't allow it to be liquidated. We need to optimize the performance through technology and other methods. Again, we need to squeeze as much capacity out of the existing system as we can before we take the next step. And we can use this through technology, whether it's ramp meters, whether it's the variable message signs, whether it's trip check, where we start to empower folks to make decisions to maybe gain some capacity because they might not choose to drive a route if indeed it's congested. So we're informing folks, and we're using all those tools. We integrate transportation, land use, economic development, and the environment. Literally, we are juggling those four balls and having to keep those balls into the air. But the bottom line, we're trying to protect and then promote investment in infrastructure. The fourth being to integrate the transportation system across jurisdictions, ownerships, and modes. Again, it's trying to connect up the modes, making sure we're as efficient in the way we move product through the various modes. But we get to an issue of governance, and I think it's been said many times, but can't be said any better, that no one really cares whether you're driving on a state, county, or city road. The bottom line is you want to get there in a safe, predictable, and efficient manner. We need to do that across the board. Create a sustainable funding plan for Oregon transportation. Again, we spoke to the inflationary bite that plays itself out specific to the gas tax. I would also say that we are challenged across all the other modes, whether it's funding for rail, funding for transit. And that's where we need to look at sustainable funding. And we need to invest strategically in capacity enhancements. We need to make sure that with the finite money funds that we do have, that we are maximizing the return and the benefit, and we are indeed addressing some of the bottlenecks and the congestion that compromises our ability to move freight and commerce. Chris spoke to what we need to do. We need to make strategic investments. We need to aggressively pursue public-private partnerships, whether that's on the construction side or whether that's on the finance side. And we need to continue to explore and use innovative technologies to improve the operations and safety. I think we will, if indeed we do that, we will position the system now, in a healthy manner, as well as we look out into the future. As we migrate from the Oregon business plan, it became a fundamental piece for some of the other challenges that we face throughout the state. And as a matter of fact, with this as a cornerstone, with some work that Chris mentioned, the Costa Congestion Report that came out of an effort from the Portland Business Alliance, Metro, ODOT, and the Port of Portland, another foundational piece, we brought roughly 70 transportation professionals over the last 8 months together to have a conversation about critical needs, how you identify the challenges that we face in each and every portfolio in the transportation world. We produced this document. Again, it shows the how much. Here's the liability we have. Chris did mention that there was a $1.3 billion gap in maintaining and preserving and strategically growing our system. This identifies how that $1.3 billion plays itself out to some extent. A menu of opportunity for investment. But it comes down to four specific points in this document. Again, somewhat redundant, but yet validating where the OTP went, validating where the cost of congestion went. We need to take care of the system. We cannot in any way liquidate or disinvest in a multi-billion dollar asset. There's too much at stake for our economic health. We need to make the system work better. Again, this is nothing more than efficiencies in the operations of our systems through technology. Again, whether it's ramp meters, the cameras, the trip check, the variable message sign, we need to, again, maximize and optimize those opportunities and make investments there because it will benefit the way the system indeed does work. Improve safety. This is just about reducing risk and exposure across the transportation continuum, whether it's in the highway portfolio, the rail portfolio, or beyond. And then we need to relieve congestion. The cost of congestion was a nice title because at the end of the day, it was business coming forward, expressing to the transportation leaders, myself, that there is truly a financial cost to congestion. They are having to make business decisions with regard to shifts, with regard to location of warehouses, with regard to new people coming on to deliver. There is an implication that if indeed there are barriers and obstacles for an efficient movement of product, it is an economic disadvantage to them. Thus, we blunt the competitive nature and the productivity of the Oregon firms that we should work very hard to promote. So those were the findings. Chris did a very good job of articulating the results. If we do nothing, we liquidate the asset. If indeed we do increase to keep up with inflation, we hold the line. But if we're judicious, we can, again, maximize those opportunities, grow this system, which means we grow the economic health of the state. I want a quick snapshot because we're always looking to the future. What are the opportunities coming at us? I want to make sure you know that we are a good investment and how we take care of the money that you do give us because it is substantial. It's roughly a $3 billion pot of money that eventually flows through local government partners and then within the portfolios of the agency. But this is a quick snapshot of not the whole of the agency but the highway portfolio. And very quickly, what I'd like to share with you, the $2 billion that flows through the highway portfolio kind of just breaks it down in the following manner. We use the bubble charts, but what I'll quickly jump to is just to maintain and preserve the system. About half, 46% of that budget goes to do just that. 23% goes to building new capacity type things, things like the third lane in Salem, the Sunnybrook Interchange out in Clackamas County, the work we've done out on 26, the Sunset work as well as the Bend Byway as we move on to Redmond and into Eastern Oregon, the Ontario investments. Debt service, again, the credit card payment, OTIA specifically, but it represents about 5% of our money flow. The planning, environmental, and just basic system management represents another 5%, and then just administrating the various programs about 9%. So that's kind of a quick numerical breakdown, percentage of what we do. And we've tried to, as you read that, if you get a chance, what we've tried to do is just put that in everyday language. I mean, this is a conversation. What does maintenance and preservation truly mean? Well, it's just kind of making sure the structure stays up, putting a roof on it. Because if you don't, you compromise the whole of the infrastructure. That becomes much more expensive. So we've tried to put it in layperson's terms. Let's move to page 13. How are we doing? I think we're good stewards. I think we're spending the money well, and the investments we make are delivering outcomes. Chris spoke to the Oregon Transportation Investment Packages, whether it's OTIA 1, 2, or 3, and he spoke about the delivery percentages. And again, 100%, 60-plus percent for OTIA 3. 90% of the OTIA state bridge money is indeed going toward Oregon firms, so we're meeting those mandates. We're meeting the mandates within those investment packages on workforce diversity. We're trying to expand the folks who migrate toward the construction trade, saying there is a career there, a good career. And we're trying to attract people from communities, minority communities, people of color, and engaging them, saying there's an opportunity to move in this direction in this career field. Now, turning the other side of the coin, it also exposes my agency to these good folks, and I think that's extremely important for me, as I can show the breadth and depth of activity that plays itself out within the Oregon Department of Transportation, exposing new people, new ways of doing business, new ways of thinking. That makes me a healthier organization. So we're not only meeting the mandates, as Chris articulated, of delivery, we're meeting the mandates of workforce diversity, of mobility, of jobs creation and growing Oregon firms. Connect Oregon, again, I think Chris was spot on when he said the $238 million of projects that we're competing for, that is not the full indication of the appetite. As a matter of fact, we were running very fast. It was a new race to be run, this multimodal conversation. I would argue that the appetite coming up for the Connect Oregon 2 conversation will represent itself similar as the appetite for the OTIAs, meaning 4 to 5 times the applications will come in for the monies you can compete. I think we were conservative. We have moved, again, the initial $25 million of bonds have gone out, and as we move toward February next month, we stand ready to issue the remaining $75. One of the things that we noted, again, collateral benefit. Of the 43 projects that were chosen that parsed out the $100 million available, it leveraged roughly $130 million more. So it really became a program of $230 million in volumes. Significant conversations about advancing projects, where there were rail projects, the Connect Oregon investment actually ratcheted up some investments that certain railroads were going to make, but they were going to make those 10 years down the road. We jump-started those opportunities as well as leveraged additional funds, to the tune of $130 million. So those are the investments. We're a good investment. Those investments are yielding dividends, I think we've checked that box. So we'll also say, just again, as we work very hard to expand the opportunities for women-owned, minority-owned type businesses, I can tell you that roughly almost $29 million of this OTIA 3 bridge money has gone toward those communities. Again, I'm proud of that, and we'll continue to explore that. I think there's opportunities because, again, that's how you expose. You gain access to the transportation conversation, and then you expose folks to grow. We spoke about the State Transportation Improvement Plan, the STIP. This is really the document which articulates the funding and the schedule of all major road highway transit projects. For any project that has state or federal funding, it's articulated in this 4-year document. It's fiscally constrained, so the projects identified in it have to have money committed toward those projects. But it is the document that we use to help inform our discussion. It is the document that all the projects make their way into. It is the document that results from the conversations that play themselves out at the Area Commissions on Transportation. It is a comprehensive, it is a disciplined, and it is a transparent conversation. We engage folks from the federal agencies, from local governments, from the Area Commissions on Transportation, from the metropolitan planning organizations, as well as just the general public as well. We ride circuit taking this document out saying, this is where your money is going. Please make comment to us. And on slide 14, we kind of articulate the various programs identified in the STIP, the type of projects that are there. How modernization projects play themselves out, how they bubble up from the ground up, and the conversation is had at the region area that eventually make those projects available to the STIP, and then the disciplines involved of how projects migrate into the STIP. What do we use? Well, we use our local government partners and their transportation system plans, or we use management plans to articulate the deficits in the bridge or in the pavement. So again, I would argue that the process is extremely difficult, is extremely disciplined, well informed, and open and transparent. So that's how the STIP document comes into being. Let me close quickly here by saying we have many challenges. We turn those into opportunities. We are seizing those opportunities. I can tell you that the agency has positioned itself well. We continue to evolve. We continue to adapt to the situation. And as we do, our private sector partners do as well. We are strong. We are structurally healthier than I think we've been in a while. Our relationships with our business partners, again, whether that is public or private, are robust. We challenge the traditional. The traditional mechanisms no longer can fully reach the resolution that we need. Thus, we need to challenge those traditional approaches, and we are in terms of finance, in terms of delivery. You'll hear a little bit later about a road fee pilot project. Again, that's challenging the traditional. We are out in front of the nation in this conversation, and all eyes are on us about a movement from the gas tax to a mileage-based fee. Our public-private partnership, again, aggressively engaging the private sector to see if there are opportunities to deliver projects that, because of the sheer size and complexity and cost, our mechanisms can't get to. Might there be another way, another funding source, and another delivery source to do such a thing? We will continue to aggressively pursue technology, going to school on that, because we see it as a way to gain capacity, to be very honest with you. Let me close, Madam Chair, by just saying that I think we are good stewards of the citizens' dollar. I think transportation is a good investment. I think you've seen those investments as dividends in the projects that you drive by coming to the great to the Capitol here. We are good for the state's economy. ODOT and our partners, again, both public and private, are currently delivering on investments. We're positioned to do that now, and we're positioned to do that into the future. So with that, Madam Chair, I stand down. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two-part question and a follow-up, if I may. Matt, when you think of Oregon's transportation system, highways, rail, water system, air. Have there been, what are the significant dates, and I'll come back to reason after that, what are the significant dates in our history? The completion of the build-out, excuse me, of the freeways in Portland, or the original completion of that system up there during the, I think it was the Goldschmidt administration. I think that was certainly an important date. But what I'm looking at is to go back and find out what important dates there were and investments that Oregonians made in the transportation system. That's the first part of my question.
There are three dates that jump out at me. 1919. State of Oregon was the first state in the nation to have a gas tax. It took place in 1919. That is an important date. It helps set a foundation for the way we continue to invest in transportation, specifically highway infrastructure. Roughly the 1950s, as the interstate investment, again, played itself out. Massive investments, a new way of doing business played itself out there. And then let me jump to the real time. I think a significant date was 2001. 2001 is when transportation was supposed to take a buy. We had some very difficult conversations in 1997 and 1999, where we were running very hard to bring the transportation story forward. But 2001, there was a change in the tenor and tone of the conversation to transportation, one that made the link to the state's economic health. That was significant. That's when the first OTIA, or the Oregon Transportation Investment Act, took place. Again, 2005 with the Connect Oregon, moving to a new way to fund a multimodal approach through lottery-backed bonds. Those representative or chair by representative Butler, those are significant dates for me. They're hinge dates because what I see is vision and leadership. It took tremendous vision, leadership, and political will to make these changes. They weren't done in it wasn't an easy time to do this thing, but there was leadership to do it. So at first blush, those are four big dates for me.
Okay. Follow up, if I may, then. Matt, and would those dates basically be the same when you consider not just movement over the overall system, but also including public transit in that process? Would there be any modification to your dating system if you were to say, let's not just look at movement of things, let's talk about movement of people?
Well, again, Chair Beyer, Representative Butler, I think if you look at that, there were significant conversations that played themselves out in the 80s and 90s with regard to some transit investments that actually took a Mount Hood freeway up in the Portland metro area and said, you know, we'll take those funds and we'll invest in a different mode of transportation that forms now a transit hub up in the Portland metro area. I think it works very well. I think it's a good commute option for the folks in the Portland metro area just because of their density. So you can certainly say the leadership of the Portland metro area, having Senator Hatfield back in Washington, certainly benefited the state of Oregon in bringing back those federal dollars to be invested in that light rail.
Madam Chair, if I may. I'm wondering, and this question comes about as a result of the concern of how we move things and people in our society today, and where we've come from and where we're going to, and if I could, I'd like to have, and not for this meeting but for a later date, I'd like to have some analysis of the percentages at those critical dates. And I'd written down about 100 years ago, 1907, around in there, but 1919 would be a good starting date. And then I'd also written down about 77, because that was my recollection of when we were in the process of beginning the people portion of the transit, when we became worried about public transit in the state of Oregon. And I'd also written down, not knowing when it was, but it was certainly during the Eisenhower administration that we began the process of the freeway interstate construction. What I'd like to do is I'd like to know what's happened to the percentage of freight that's moved today compared to those other critical dates, and the percentage which has been moved by rail, by highways and trucks, by air, and by water, barge and river. And then a separate matrix on the percentage of people miles, how we're moving people in the state of Oregon on our highways, on rail, on air, and water, and public transit. Those five for people, if we could. I'd really like to see where we're going in that matrix, if we're making any headway. And my concern, Madam Chair, so that you'll see what I'm trying to get at, and maybe this will be an exercise in futility, but my concern is I think we're going behind very critically in the rail process. I think we've shifted from the rails to the road, and then we wonder why our roads don't have the capacity, and we just, you know, we're wearing them out. And I'm looking at that and I'm saying, you know, I'm wondering if rail, where it carries a lot of freight, and I've shared this with Matt's rail division person, Kelly Taylor. The way I determine Oregon's economy as I'm traveling back and forth to Ontario is I count the number of trains on the Oregon side. I count the number of trains, and if we've got 14 or less trains, then I'm very pessimistic about how our economy is doing. But when I get to 17, 18, 19 trains, and I say, you know what, and I don't care whether they're coming or going to the port, I just want to see them moving our lumber and moving, you know, things from to and from the port. But when I get up to that point, then I start feeling pretty optimistic about how everything is going in Oregon. So, but I am very, very anxious when I count those trains and I see over half of them idle, waiting for some other train to come, because we just don't have the infrastructure and the ability or the capacity to carry trains going in each direction. And then, if I may, Madam Chair, as I look on page 14 of this nice Oregon's transportation plan, the executive summary, and I guess that's what really spurs this on, when I see on 14, and this is a great picture of three people crawling onto an Amtrak walking across a bunch of tracks. I'm looking at that and I'm saying, you know, when you travel in 99% of the developed countries in this world and you go to their train stations, you'll see the train stations filled with people, not just going across Portland or not just transporting themselves around in the metropolitan district, such as Representative Tomei's district, but going really somewhere, going to another country. And in Oregon, you know, we've got three people crossing one set of tracks to walk in front of an Amtrak to see if they can get on somewhere. So I'm anxious about that.
Thank you.
Thank
I
you,
was
Madam
wondering
Chair.
If that was in Eugene. It looks like it.
I think Chair Bile, Representative Butler, we truly, I would embrace a robust conversation about rail infrastructure. I think you have targeted on an area where we it's a liability. I would hope that the committee would engage in a healthy conversation about rail. I would ask that the question as we seek to find the answers and the to the questions you pose, it be an iterative process. Continue to inform this. We'll bring what we have to make sure that you have a comprehensive picture.
Great.
Of the challenges we face.
Thank you. I'm sure. Thank you.
Appreciate it. We'll see if we can get your questions answered. Representative Smith and then Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Chair Breyer. I actually have five quick things. A couple of them are comments, then two questions. One, Matt, I really want to compliment the department on the work you're doing with the emerging and small business component within the department. And I would hope, Madam Chair, that we'd provide them with an opportunity to come show us the good work they're doing, because they really are reaching out to emerging entrepreneurs throughout the state, to female-owned businesses, and to minority-owned businesses. And they've got a great little program that really encourages folks to step up and to work with the state of Oregon. It's a great win for us. Second, I would hope we would be able to have a robust discussion on what Representative Tomei was talking about. That's the Selwood Bridge, but also the thought of developing a new bridge between Oregon and Washington and over the Columbia River. As you talk about bottlenecks and trying to move transportation or trying to move cargo more efficiently, I think you've got a huge bottleneck there. And if at some point in time the state of Oregon is going to have to address that issue. From my perspective from rural eastern Oregon, when bridges such as the Selwood and a bridge over the Oregon, over to Washington across the Columbia, when those are developed and enhanced, it benefits all of the state of Oregon. It really does. And so I'd hope we'd be able to have a discussion on that, just as a thought. Last thought, and then I have two questions. I don't want to embarrass anyone, so I'm just going to throw it out there. In the governor's inaugural address, he talked about the importance of us looking at alternative energies sources, and I would hope the Oregon Department of Transportation would lead by example and ensure that the state motor pool is having those vehicles operating on ethanol or biofuels. I think it'd be very hypocritical for us as a state to say we're going to have these mandates but not make sure our own motor pool has that. And so I don't want any comment on that. I just share that thought with you. Two comments, or two questions, really quick. I noticed that Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas County don't have an act. Can you share with the committee why that is?
You bet, Chair Beyer. Representative Smith, what they have right now is the Joint Policy Advisory Committee on Transportation, JPEC. It's the MPO, or the Metropolitan Planning Organization, federally created entity. We are having discussions with our friends up in the Portland metro area, but as of right now, they think the structure with this JPAC conversation, for all intents and purposes, acts and engages as an Area Commission on Transportation. We do think there's some issues with composition. Those are elected officials, and we certainly embrace and encourage elected officials to participate. As a matter of fact, I think the bylaws of the acts say you have to have at least 51%, and I would argue the majority are much higher than that. But that said, we think it's important that the private sector, business and industry, as well as other stakeholders, sit around that discussion table. I think their input better informs the overall discourse. So that's just the difference between JPAC and our area commissions. We continue to have conversations with our friends up there. It's just an evolutionary process.
Thank you. And my last question. Three terms ago, this body created a freight advisory committee. And now we're working with Connect Oregon, hopefully at Connect Oregon 2. And simultaneously, the Department of Economic and Community Development is dismantling or reorganizing its ports division to where they're going to from the port's perspective, lose their influence. Is there any possibility of having a discussion of moving the ports division over to ODOT, where perhaps it makes more sense for them to be located?
Chair Byer, Representative Smith, there's always opportunity to have the discussion. But that said, no one's come to me to share that concern. I will tell you that I did, three sessions ago, have the privilege of being the staffer for ODOT as the Freight Advisory Committee was birthed. I certainly understand the import of that. They have certainly advised the Transportation Commission as well as my agency in strong terms, bringing focus to the challenges of freight movement throughout the state of Oregon. I'll sit down with my friend Bob Repine. We can have a discussion. It's my understanding that economic development did bring in a new person specific to ports, and I'm not sure how that's playing out, but that'll be part of the discussion I have with Mr. Repine.
Well, I just share with the committee that, you know, ports are those hubs where rail, barge, trucking, air, aviation, and quite often public transit all come together. To me, it just has never made sense that that hasn't been put under the Oregon Department of Transportation, where they have the most natural fit. And at the same time, I think the Economic and Community Development Department is looking at refocusing its efforts in a direction that doesn't focus on ports, and perhaps there's an opportunity for a divorce and a new marriage, I guess, a better marriage. So I can share that with you.
Thank
and
you.
I don't know a better way to put it other than that, because that's what it would be.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank you, and for thanks to all of your staff who have facilitated the beautiful work on 99E in Milwaukee. It's helped jumpstart the redevelopment of our downtown area and redevelopment of the park along the beautiful riverfront. So thank you.
Well, Chair Byer, Representative Tomei, I want to say it's certainly been a pleasure working with the city of Milwaukee. That truly is really a snapshot of the challenges we face, where a main street is a state highway. And how do we make sure we make investments that don't in no way compromises the functionality outside that downtown area, but make the investment so it actually gives a facelift to downtown Milwaukee. It was a pleasure working with our local government partners there. We have a beautiful project there, no question.
It is beautiful. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Smith, I come from an area that doesn't have an act either, so there's always talk, but so far it hasn't moved anywhere. Mm-hmm. And I want to thank you, Matt. One of the things I do want to tell the committee is that don't ever hesitate to contact any of the people at ODOT if you have questions. They're always happy to work with you. There's a few faces out there if you're not familiar with. They can introduce themselves to you, but make use of that. I mean, it's a big agency, and it helps to get yourself oriented to it. And I'm going to go ahead, I think, and let Matt introduce the next subject, which is the Road User Fee Task Force.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, Matthew Garrett, Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. Mr. James Witte was to give this presentation. Unfortunately, where he lives, he's still iced up, so he couldn't make it out of here. But we have Betsy Imholt of the Office of Innovative Partnerships, who will speak to some issues as to where we are currently, where we are going into the future, the lessons we've learned, and to correct any statements that I may make here as I open things up. We just spoke to you about how Oregon has taken on the challenges to find new ways, innovative ways, to finance, operate, and maintain the transportation system. The road user pilot program being one such way. With this road user fee pilot, Oregon is indeed the first state, as I've said before, to really take a serious look at moving from the gas tax toward a mileage-based fee. It's an approach that's not academic. This is one that truly integrates the real-time conversation, the realities of the pump. It integrates extremely well without having much impact, if any, on the consumer itself. Now, the gas tax is the traditional mechanism in delivering revenues for highway infrastructure. It will remain that way for the near term. This is a conversation that's out maybe a decade or so, but we're on the balls of our feet engaging this conversation because the gas tax is compromised. We spoke about the inflationary bite. Other externalities at play here, the demand for higher fuel-efficient cars. I think as the gas prices swing in volatile manners, mostly swinging up, we've been plateaued at about 20, 21 miles a gallon since the 1970s. I think there's going to be a push for more fuel-efficient vehicles. Now, the impact is they're not coming back to the pump as often, it's generating the money going back to pay for infrastructure improvements or expansion. And then finally, and I don't know if this is a trend or it's just a fad, but we certainly see the composition of the fleet changing. Hybrids are moving into that conversation. Again, a long-term discussion playing itself out here, but it is changing the composition, thus compromising the purchasing power associated with your gas tax. So we did indeed kick off a pilot project back in March of 2006 as a way, I think, to bring stability to transportation finance. We identified 260 volunteers. They came to us up in the Portland metro region. They had their vehicles equipped with onboard mileage counters. This is GPS technology. We got a little prop here to show you. It truly just counts the number of miles driven in the state of Oregon. There were two gasoline service stations equipped in southeast Portland with mileage, similar type devices, but mileage reading. So we have the mileage onboard mileage counter. We have the reader at the pump and two service stations up in the Portland metro. I had the privilege of bringing the U.S. Secretary of Transportation, Mary Peters, to the site, and I would extend that invitation to you, Madam Chair, and your committee, if indeed you'd like to see how this activity is playing itself out. The clock is ticking. I think we come to a close here in a matter of months, but should anyone want to take a trip up to Portland and look at the way this operation functions, more than happy to make those arrangements. Simply put, when you drive up to this gas station and while you're refueling, the onboard mileage counter communicates with the mileage reader at the pump, and when the purchase is totaled, the 24 cents of state gas tax is deducted from that total. A fee of roughly 1.2 cents per mile is calculated, and then a receipt is distributed to the customer. It is literally seamless. The only thing that the customer sees is a different-looking receipt. I think in your materials you have a copy of what that receipt looks like. Now, very quickly, there are three issues that have bloomed in our conversation, the first and foremost being privacy. There was a concern that you put this equipment in a person's car, you are literally tracking them. I want to remind you that we're not tracking the movements of anyone here. We are really only counting the miles they drive in the state of Oregon. The second issue that was raised was, are you reducing the incentive for me to purchase a fuel-efficient vehicle? If indeed I want to buy a Prius and Ms. Imholt wants to drive a Hummer, do we treat me the same as Ms. Imholt? Well, I think it's a valid concern, but a couple thoughts on that front. Literally, there's little impact moving the gas tax for 24 cents. That's roughly less than 10% of what we pay for gas right now. So there's not a whole lot of financial implication there, but there is some. So I would offer that there could be a policy conversation that establishes different rate structures. You could incent, maybe drop down the per mile fee for a Prius, while Ms. Einholz, driving her Hummer, could pay the full 1.2. The third issue, and I will wrap up here and turn it over to Betsy very quickly, but the third issue is cost. This is the long-term conversation Betsy will get in. What is the true cost of transitioning to this new technology? We're still studying that. That actually probably is the next phase of our conversation. There are long-term implications on directions. We need national standards coming down from the federal government, if indeed you need to put this type of equipment in the car itself. Those national conversations, those federal directions are part of, I think, the second chapter that we need to write in this conversation. But we are laying foundational work with this pilot project. What I'd like to do now, Madam Chair, is turn it over to Betsy. She's going to discuss where we are currently in this conversation, some of the lessons learned, and we have learned some lessons, and the next steps associated with this road user pilot.
Thanks, Director. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Betsy Imholt with the Oregon Department of Transportation. Before I get into the where we are now, I think it is important just to make sure that you all know that this whole project came about from the legislature, actually. In 2001, they created the Road User Fee Task Force, which met several times, looked at 28 different solutions for replacing the gas tax. This was one of them, and they recommended to ODOT that we go forth and study it, and that's what we're doing. As Matt said, the concept for this whole pilot rests on electronic counting of miles. Notice that we do not say tracking of where motorists go, because that is not what we're doing. But we count the miles driven by geographic zone. Those zones can be set any number of ways. We've set three for our pilot. The zones are in Oregon, out of Oregon, and the whole entire Portland metropolitan area. So those are the zones that we're collecting miles in. That information, as Matt said, is transmitted at the fueling station via wireless transaction. It's seamless to the attendant, and it's seamless to the motorist. We launched the study last spring with 260 volunteers and two gas stations. Leathers Fuel is our partner in this. Funding for the project comes from the Federal Highway Administration. They fund the bulk of it with a grant of $2.1 million, and that's been over the course of 6 years. And Oregon's share is $770,000. This project has generated a lot of interest from not only here in the United States, but literally around the world. And it has been an honor to work on this project in that regard. We have literally emerged as the world leader on this body of research. And mileage fees in and of themselves is not a new idea, but what is very novel about the Oregon concept is how it's collected at the pump. No one has been able to figure out how to do that. We are the first to have a concept and actually prove it in a real study. Just yesterday, we had a news report that the governor of Minnesota will run a similar pilot project this year, and their House Transportation Finance Chair is very supportive of the mileage fee too. So we'll probably see some work coming out of Minnesota this year. That'll be exciting. We have also had a lot of media attention and interest from transportation officials from around the world, including Japan, Germany, New Zealand, Great Britain, and the European Union. Japan sent an entire delegation out here, as did Texas. Last year, we've had news stories in the New York Times, Chicago Tribune, Financial Times of London, and hundreds of other regional publications, some good, some bad. One very important article that we included in your packet today is one from The Bond Buyer. This is a daily newspaper for the public financial markets, and the article speaks favorably about using mileage fees to back revenue bonds while maintaining strong credit during unexpected reductions in the fuel tax. So that's just something that we provided for your information. Our project timeline. We currently are nearing the end of our project. We started last spring, as we said, and the pilot will be operating for 2 more months, and then it will be wrapping up. We'll then enter into our analysis phase. We do hope to get something to the legislature before you adjourn to outline our results as far as we can at that point. The final report will probably be done after you leave. Lessons learned so far. The pilot has been successful, if I might say. The equipment is working and the transactions are taking place at the pump as they're supposed to. But the two big things that we've learned so far is, first, that retrofitting is not a good idea. And we knew that. We had that suspicion before we got into it, but it was really confirmed. We've had 20 or so of our cars, our great participants, go out in the morning and their batteries are dead. So that's been a black mark on us. We have replaced their batteries. But the device has, we could not have tested on every single make and model of car that exists. On the tests that we did do, we didn't have that problem. But in real life, we're having that problem. There's a slight drain of energy, and it affects some cars different than others. So that's been a problem. One thing that we would like to do in the future, if this was ever to happen in the real world, we would proposed that this needs to be engineered into the vehicle at the manufacturer level. A lot of these components and even more sophisticated ones already exist in the OnStar system. So this isn't as crazy as it might sound. The one thing that we would also hope that we could get is, this is the screen that is mounted, that we mount with a suction cup onto the participant's vehicle, so they can know what zone they're in and how many miles they're accumulating. ideally, in the real world, we'd like this to be about money, so they could see how much this is costing, depending on which zone they're in and where they were. And that could influence behavior, should you want to do that. But this also would need to be integrated into the dashboard somehow. Some vehicles already have, like a Toyota Prius already has a screen, and so you could do that. Other vehicles don't. But we think this is an important tool to connect behavior to what's going on. The second lesson learned is our short-range communication that we're using at the pump is not working as well as it would need to in the real world. We're having about an 85% success rate, and that obviously isn't good enough. The radio frequency transmission that is occurring is, it's just touchy, to be honest. It depends on where the antenna is placed on the car. If we have a real big van, sometimes we're having a hard time reading. We had a problem with the Porsche we couldn't get a read from because it was too low. We think that we can improve this by connecting the technology from the pump nozzle to the vehicle. And because every vehicle has to actually touch the pump, that there could actually be a better connection there rather than the so many feet that we're trying to communicate now. The next steps. Before we could ever implement this here or anywhere else, there's a few things that we would like to look into. One is improving the experience at the pump with the technology improvement that I just spoke of, as well as working. We'd love to work with the auto manufacturer to develop specs and to maybe even get some cars with this stuff engineered into it and to test that out and to start that conversation. We have not done that yet, mostly because we have learned from working with the gasoline industry that we need to have money before anyone will talk to us. So that's something that we would like to do if we ever were able to identify an additional grant. Second, we would like to work on developing standards and processes to allow for nationwide implementation. If Minnesota did adopt something, and we also had something here in Oregon, how would those systems work together? And we would like to work on that. We've got some really good ideas on how to do that. And the third thing is what Matt had suggested, develop firm cost estimates for full mileage fee implementation in Oregon. Our guess is now, which are a couple years old, is somewhere around $33 million. The cost in this is outfitting the gas stations because they have to have one of these on all their pumps, as well as their point-of-sale systems have to be modified so that they can deduct the gas tax and add the mileage fee, depending on what kind of car is at the pump. So those are the three things we'd like to work on. But as I mentioned, we would need to identify additional grant resources in order to work on those things. When this project's over in a few months, our money's gone. So that's kind of where we stand with that. In summary, I would just like to echo what Matt said, that this really is a research project. Although it's fun work and we are excited about it, you can probably tell that I am, that does not mean that we are looking to adopt this tomorrow. This is research. That's how we look at it. We look at it as an option that will be available to you should you ever decide that you need to move in another direction because of what the gas tax is doing. And also please know that we would love to have you out to one of the gas stations to witness a transaction, to meet a couple participants. If that sounds interesting to you, we'd love to have you either as a group or individually. We'll be doing tours on Fridays. And with that, I will take your questions.
Thank you. Any questions?
Goodbye.
Okay.
Madam Chair, thank you. Just out of curiosity, how much does that little device cost to put on a car?
These ran, to have them produced and installed, about $250. Keep in mind that it's a very small run, and these were custom made for us. This was not an off-the-shelf device.
Okay, thank you.
Yes?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'm still confused. How do you pay the fee?
You pay the fee just as you do now. And
so you run up the miles, you go to get your gas, and it's calculated, and it's... You're assessed the fee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's right. Representative Smith, I mean, that's what's really unique about this is that it integrates seamlessly with the gas tax. If we were to only have these installed in new vehicles as they came off of the line, which is what we would recommend, then we're going to have some people paying the mileage fee and some people paying the gas tax. As you pull into the pump automatically knows if it doesn't get a signal, like now, then that's a gas taxpayer. Or if that person's from out of state, any of those things where it doesn't get a signal, it would know to charge you the gas tax. If it does get a signal, then it deducts that gas tax and adds the mileage fee since the last time you paid, and it it levies that right there at the pump. And that's what makes this unique, because there's literally no enforcement of, or collection, I should say. There is enforcement, but there isn't collection of the fee centrally. There's no accounting that we have to do. All other studies of this nature include some ginormous centralized accounting system, which, as you might imagine, would be very, very labor-intensive and expensive.
I think, Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I'm a visual type person. I appreciate your question. I struggle with this. But in the very back page of the testimony really walks you through in a schematic way and really shows you what the receipt looks like, and you can literally do the math as the gas tax is eliminated and the per mile fee is charged, and you can see the difference between a gas tax charge versus a per mile charge. So the schematic helped me, because I'm a visual person.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Any? Okay.
Madam Chair, just one question relative to the actual distributor. Fortunately, Leathers Oil has an account with the state where it pays its gas taxes separately. I'm assuming that in their reporting system now they have to have a separate line where they subtract out the per gallon fee and add in the per mile fee. So it's a reporting issue at Leathers Oil Company.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Butler, you're right. What we do is, and we're practicing this too, is what we call a true-up process, where we find out what the difference is between what they had already paid for their gas and the amount that they've taken in, or the amount that they're shorted, or in the plus of the mileage fee, and then we reconcile monthly with them. And we are doing that right now. It's part of the test. And it's going pretty smoothly, I have to say.
Thank you. Representative Reed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just curious about the rush hour. It sounds like that's also a zone in addition to geographic areas of the time, so the machine's also collecting when those miles may be accumulated.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Reed, that's correct. The rush hour zone, first let me say that in order to get the grant, we had to do what they call congestion pricing. And so we are studying that in this test. And the congestion zone is the entire urban growth boundary of the metropolitan area, and there's times associated with that. The regular per mile charge is 1.2 cents a mile. For the special group that's doing the rush hour pricing, it's 10 cents a mile when they're in that zone, 2 hours in the morning and 2 hours at night on weekdays. And these little things know that automatically when they're in that, and so those miles are calculated in that zone and charge that fee for those participants.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
I appreciate the update. I've been kind of following it, but it's been a while. So.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, committee, if there's anything else? Nothing else? Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. Close the informational hearing, and we'll open a work session for introduction of committee bills. And I don't know if anybody took a look at the ones that were there. Okay. All right. They aren't listed. So draft LC draft 2101 is a county bill, and it imposes a fee for the issuance of the first Oregon certificate of title. And that means if someone brings a car in that's and titles it, if it's an older car and they bring it in, it hasn't been titled in Oregon, they would charge for that. If it's a new car, they would charge for that. And I think there is a little bit different, I'm not sure. I would say that I thought there was a little different distribution of it, but I'm not positive. If you read it, you probably know more than I do about it. So that is LC 2101. The second one is pretty self-explanatory, which is creates the offense of operating a motor vehicle while using a mobile communication device, with a fine of $90 is what this is. So these are the two LCs, and if...
Madam Chair, let me say this with regard to the first bill. The counties only receive a portion, and the apportionment, the counties receive 30%, and the other 70% goes 50% to the department and 20% to the cities. That's
the standard.
I hesitate to call that a county bill, but certainly the counties end up with some additional funds.
The counties are the ones that have an interest in this bill, and is the standard distribution.
Thank you. And the second bill, which imposes a minimum or a maximum fine of $90 for not using both hands on the wheel while I'm trying to make a telephone call, is of concern to me because I'll never voluntarily vote for something that's going to impose a fine on the way I drive. recognizing that at least one time during my entire career, I'm going to vote yes on a tax. I think this had better be the one time I vote yes. So I'm going to move that LCs 2101 and 2365 be submitted as committee submitted bills on behalf of the Transportation Committee.
Thank you. Is there any discussion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize. This is the first time I've had an opportunity to see these bills, and while in the future I may be able to change my mind on them, I'm going to give a no vote to both of these.
Thank you. All right. Any other comments? Remember that this is just a vote to introduce them, as he has said, and this does not commit you to a vote on these bills on the floor. So that's since we evidently have someone who will be voting no, we'll go ahead and take a roll call vote.
You want to do one at a time?
Okay. You want
it? Sure. Madam Chair, I move LC draft 20.
I'm learning.
Adam,
you everybody.
Thank you. 2101. And you want a date too? Oh, 12/28/06. Mm-hmm. And LC, what's the other one? That's 2101. 2365, dated 1/11/07, be introduced as committee bills.
Representative Gilman moves LC draft 2101, dated 12/28/06, and LC 2365, dated 1/11/07, to be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Yes. See.
There's going to be one in every group.
Want to take a roll? Okay. I do have a script. Thank you, everybody, for bearing with me. Those of the opinion that LC draft 2101
why don't we do 1 minute time?
Yeah, should be introduced as a committee bill will say aye.
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 Those opposed?
Nay.
Clerk will go.
That's fine. That's okay. Voice vote is fine.
All right. And motion carries on LC draft 2101. And those of the opinion that LC draft 2365 should be introduced as committee bill will say aye.
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 Those opposed?
Nay.
No.
Nay. Two.
Okay.
Two.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, may I suggest that you say who voted nay since?
Okay. Thank you. It is noted that Representative Smith has voted no on LC 2101, and that Representative Smith and Representative Butler have voted no on LC 2365.
Motion still carries.
And the motion carries. Thank you. And with that, we are adjourned, and we'll see you Friday. I'm going to get this right.